We're going to only use whole animals and carcasses. We're going to focus on dry aging those carcasses. And we're going to try and make every single product original and from scratch.
This is the Australian Butchers Guild Podcast, brought to you by Meat and Livestock Australia, the podcast for passionate butchers.
G'day and welcome to another episode of the Australian Butchers Guild Podcast. I'm your host, Doug Piper. I hope you're enjoying the episodes as we get through the year. Today I'm talking to the owner of Whole Beast Butchery, Marcus Papadopoulou. I hope I didn't butcher that one up, mate. Marcus runs a small, unique butcher shop in the inner Sydney suburb of Marrickville. In the 1980s, Marrickville had a huge European population. The shopping village consisted of so many different types of businesses like barbers, hairdressers, cobblers, mechanics, cafes, delicatessens, and even the old popular Frutto. And also, they had some great family-run butcher shops. Back then, the majority of meat sold in butcher shops would have come from Homebush Abattoirs, which is about a couple of kilometres down the road. These days, that part of Marrickville is a very old and trendy area that's home to a diverse cultural community. It still has plenty of restaurants and cafes to eat at and is the home of the Whole Beast Butchery. Welcome, Marcus.
Thank you for having me. How are you doing?
I'm doing well, mate. And what are you up to today?
Mate, I am cutting meat for the good people of the area, which is Marrickville.
Marrickville, eh? Yeah. I was down there the other day, mate, and it's an interesting little spot down there.
Yeah, it is. It is. It's got a long butcher shop history.
Yeah.
You know, it's funny. It's a funny area. It used to be booming, and now it's booming in a different way. It's not what it was, but it's something new. It's becoming something new.
I remember a long time ago in the 90s, I was working in Leichhardt, which is, you know, the next suburb over, really, right next door to Marrickville. And very different demographics, great people to deal with, good customers. I was working for a supermarket then, and they loved fresh meat.
Mm.
And I think we hit that the other day, didn't we? We were talking about how customers like coming into a shop and seeing the meat there and being able to sort of say, I want that part or I want this piece, and you break it down in front of them.
Those people as well, they love to see the butcher there.
Yeah.
That was really important to them. Just like being on a name basis was a really important thing, and it still is. But back then, it was people were asking for certain butchers. If your shop was called, Marrickville Meats, they knew Marrickville Meats was George's shop. And they're looking for George and they're asking for George.
Yeah.
And if George isn't there, they know the other guys or they're expecting someone, you know?
Yeah, exactly. So mate, the Whole Beast Butchery, how did you come up with that name? What drove you to call a butcher shop Whole Beast Butchery?
My initial idea in mind is I decided that if I'm going to open this butcher shop, we're going to do three things. We're going to only use whole animals and carcasses. We're going to focus on dry aging those carcasses. And we're going to try and make every single product original and from scratch. Those are the three things we're going to do. And I called it Whole Beast Butchery because it was all about buying whole bodies, getting whole beef, getting whole lamb, getting whole pigs, and keeping them in the conditions of maturation, which is in a dry age room, to develop them in terms of their texture and their flavor, and give them a minimum amount of time to hang, and then work off them. I had a bit of a different idea. The first thing is, to be honest, that when I decided to open up this butcher shop, I had an opportunity to do so, but I'd never touched a whole body of anything. In fact, I'd only ever cut up one whole pig maybe 4 months before, and it was a 40-kilo pig that I rolled into a porchetta. Other than that, I'd seen bodies of beef, like maybe a year prior to that, and I'd seen a few whole lambs. I'd never really seen a whole pig. I'd seen them broken up in front of me when I worked in Vic's meat factory, but I wasn't involved. Like, I was very green at the time. It was like things were going around me. I didn't even know what I'm looking at. But that's the only time I saw whole bodies, the only time I ever touched them, you know?
So how did you hone the skill? How did you go about learning how to break bodies? Was it did you go back to TAFE or did you just sort of, you worked with other butchers that showed you how to do it?
To be honest, I taught myself by putting myself in the deep end, and I watched a lot of videos and I read a lot of books that are available on butchery, which there isn't many. But it was a lot of just playing around. I had a small, tiny butcher shop that was very quiet, and I had a body of beef, and I didn't even know what I was looking at. Didn't even know what a fork quarter was going to look like. And it got delivered to my shop, and I just stared in front of it and figured it out. And I cost myself a lot of money doing so, and the execution was really poor. you know, but I had a real laser focus on making it of a craftsmanship approach of learning how to break down an animal, how to get every single cut out of it and to utilize every single cut and make it a saleable cut, you know, make it something that you can sell.
We do learn from our mistakes, don't we? And normally you would only make that mistake once.
Yeah, I made a couple of them a couple of times. Yeah, I still make
mistakes. We all do, mate. Well, no one's perfect. We all make mistakes, you know. Life is a one big long learning curve, you know. We're forever learning. The day you stop learning is the day that you're 6 foot under the ground.
Yeah.
So have you had anybody in particular as an influence in your career that got you started in butchery? Were you working as a, you know, a cleanup boy, or is there some reason why you wanted?
Well, my story is a little bit of a different one. I'm one of the few people that I know that actually chose to get into the craft.
Uh-huh.
I changed what I was doing and took a different direction and seeked out an apprenticeship. So I was at uni. I was working in the car parking industry, actually, for Wilson Parking. And I was starting to develop a job where it could become a career. And I was going to university at the time. I hated university. And I didn't know what I wanted to do, but I knew I wanted a job and learn something and really get some sort of knowledge and potentially put it towards a business idea. And all I knew was that I really was interested in food, and I knew nothing about food. I didn't really come from a family background where we ate lots of food. We had no appreciation for produce, no idea about food in general. I didn't know how to cook, whatever. I just knew that something I was interested in doing. So I just applied for an apprenticeship that I found on Seek, and I got it, and I got as an apprentice, and I went into a butcher shop that just happened to be around the corner from where I lived, just randomly. I didn't even know it was there. And I was expecting straight away to go into a place that was going to be full of some sort of artistic mindset, in the same way that I saw chefs on TV or chefs in documentaries or whatever. And straight away, I realized it was not that. Everybody that was there hated the bosses, and they hated their life and hated being there. And it was a bad experience immediately. And I was really expecting some artisans, craftsmen, and I got chucked in with a bunch of tradesmen, right? And I worked this job in the beginning, and nobody was teaching me anything. I remember, like, the second day, I asked one of the butchers, what's a steel? Like, one of the steels for honing your knives. And he's like, mate, you're not going to need one for a year, so don't even worry. Right? That was his approach. I quit my job and was still working on my off days. So I was working 13 days a fortnight, 10 in the butcher shop, 3 in the car parking, just to pay my rent. Because I went down to probably a third of the pay I was making an hour. It was grim, but I was like, I'm interested, you know, but it sucked. And I was talking to my grandfather, and my family background is Croatian. And they said to me, you know, we know someone that's a butcher. And I was like, okay, who? And they're like, oh, we're really good friends with this, with somebody who's very close to this family, the Paharichs, who own Vic's Meat. And then we end up in Mascot Factory. I thought we were going to a butcher shop, right? I was dressed up for a job interview. I remember I had pants, like nice pants, nice shoes, I had a shirt on. And they take me to this factory, and I was like, where are we in Mascot? I'd never even been to Mascot. And they take me upstairs, and Vic's there, and Vic is just like, he's smashing cherries. I remember he was smashing cherries out, just eating them. He's like, I got all these cherries, have a cherry. I was like, okay, no worries. And we start chatting. He's like, you want to be a butcher? And I was like, I do. I'm at somewhere right now. I don't think it's the right place. I want to learn how to do this. And he goes, no worries, you're going to start in 2 days. I was like, great, thank you. And he's like, you're going to start at 2. Is it in the afternoon? He goes, oh, I thought it was early. I was like, what do you mean? He goes, 2 a.m. You're going to start 2 a.m. downstairs. I was like, okay. I got a job working in the factory there. It was very intimidating. It was full on. I was working in the boning room. Everybody around me, now that I really think about it, they're all absolute guns. And then in that week, 2 times, I fell asleep driving because I was working from 2 a.m. to 12 p.m. I fell asleep driving, and it was bad. And I was like, I don't want to live like this. This is not the lifestyle for me. And I felt really bad because this guy that I met, who's a friend of my grandparents, gave me this job, and this is not, it's not going to work for me. Like, I could just tell. I was like, I didn't see my partner Amina at all, you know, like just a little bit. I was falling asleep at night at 7 o'clock. It wasn't for me, you know? And I was like, this is like a veteran's job. And I had a meeting with Anthony Paharich and the head butcher, And I decided I couldn't do the job anymore, right? And they were meeting with me to tell me about how do I join up TAFE and start the official apprenticeship. And I was like, oh, you know, thanks for the opportunity. I was like, but this isn't for me. I was like, I like this job, but I can't do this. And he said to me, do you still want to be a butcher? And I was like, yeah, I do, but I don't know what I'm going to do now. And he's like, I have two shops. And he said, there's one in the fish markets and there's one in Woollahra. He's like, if you really want to be a butcher, I'll let you work at both of them for 2 weeks and then you tell me which one you want to work for. And I was like, whoa. I was like, yes, please. Like, thank you. It was an amazing opportunity that he was willing to even let me make my own decision. And I went to the fish markets and straight away I was like, this is for me. I like it. This is good. Much better. And I love that. But then after 2 weeks, I went to Victor Churchill. And I spent one day there with Darren O'Rourke and Mickey Peacock at the time. And Darren was the head butcher. And straight away, I was like, this is my job. That was the first place I ever went where everybody there, including those two specifically, were craftsmen. And they had the attitude of people that are there because this is an art form that we're going to focus all of our efforts on to do the highest quality. All the meat is very, very high quality. The standard is extremely high. This is a very special place to be. And I got that immediately. And that's where I started. And those two guys showed me so much. Victor Churchill is one of those places where they don't break bodies at the shop. But what they do is the highest level of execution for the middle to final stages of meat cutting. It was a great opportunity. Really, like, it got my fire in my stomach about butchery, and I wanted to learn. I wanted to be as good as the guys that I was working with. So I worked there for a year, and I really learned a lot of skills, and I put a lot of effort in to all my apprentice work, get that done at a very high level, very quickly, so that these guys would give me the opportunity to learn how to use a bandsaw, how to cut a dry age OP rib into other cuts, you know, and break it down and French bones and work at the same pace as them, where I could get to the level where I do one for every three that they do. My partner, Mina, she used to work for a company called Fourth Village, which is based in Mossman. And they opened up another shop, which was a big fruit and veg and deli providor in Waterloo at the time on Dank Street. And they basically approached me and they said, we have this space. If you have an idea, you need to come up with a certain amount of money and we will help you by bringing trades in to set up a place for you that you're going to have to pay back as a loan. And I needed to come up with my own money and my own working capital for this business and everything. And if you want to open up a butcher shop, we're going to give you an opportunity to do so. That happening so soon, it was just something I had to do. And I had the support of Amina to do it. And we came up with this idea of how I wanted to do it. And I started. You walked into the butcher shop, the customer area was like 4 square meters. On the very left of them was a four-door fridge, which I still have, you know. And on the right of them was my butcher's block and a wrapping station and a cash register. And in front of it was a cool room with glass. It was a glass cool room. And I put rails inside and I just bought bodies and I put them in there and I dry-aged them for 4 weeks before we opened. Then I did it. I opened up, you know. And that was the beginning of Whole Beast Butchery, which was in February of 2017.
That's a great story, mate. Like, you've gone from knowing nothing about butchery into a business, running a business within, what, a couple of years, under a couple of years. So, you know, that not many guys can do that. And it's great to have that drive to hear your passion about the trade too.
Yeah.
Because there's a lot of butchers out there that are extremely passionate about what they do and how they do it and how they present the meat to the customers. Everybody's got their own different little quirky ways. And even going back to when you first started, it's not unusual. I knew a guy who told me for the first 12 months of his butchery apprenticeship, he had a scrubbing brush in his kit. No, he didn't have knives. He had a scrubbing brush in it. So one day I'm going to get to do it. But striving to get there is something that's a credit to you, because, you know, you noticed that if I did it this way, if I did all of the menial jobs first, like your crumbing and whether you're making sausages or whatever, getting that out of the way first so you can go out there and get on the knives.
Yeah.
I think that's a great trait to have because you knew where you wanted to go. You knew the direction you wanted to go.
Yeah. And I was lucky. I just had great guys and it was a great environment.
Yeah.
And an amazing shop. It's a full-on, incredible shop to work in. And it's an amazing business to work for in Vic's Meat because it has so many different elements and so many layers. But being in that Victor Churchill shop, that's what inspired me to take meat to the level of the highest quality. Then when I opened the shop, the idea was in my head that I see a lot of different brands. I see that butcher shops, they often have like the top shelf, the middle shelf. They have three different types of sirloins, three different types of scotch fillets, one wagyu, one grain fed. And my idea was that I'm just going to pick the one which I prefer, which is pasture-raised grass-fed meat that's free range. And we're just going to sell that. And in my opinion, dry-aged meat is the highest format in terms of quality of flavor and texture that bodies can be. So Let's dry-age everything. That's what we do. We do dry-aged meat. The other element that I wanted to do was I wanted to make sure that every single customer experienced the level of service, which was meat being cut for them. So my display, and it's still like this in my butcher shop now, probably 95% of the meat that's in the fridge, it requires further cutting. It requires a butcher to speak directly with a person and ask them what they're looking for, how they're going to cook something, how many people they're going to feed, then breaking down options for them, then choosing a piece and then cutting it again. So there's no pre-cut T-bones in my shop. There's no, the rumps are all whole boned out. You know, all the racks are whole because meat lasts better like that. It ages better like that. And the less amount of time between the final cut and the cooking, the better the quality of the product is. So why not cut lamb cutlets for people when they show up?
Yeah, I remember the days when I worked for the supermarket chain Franklin's Big Fresh when we'd get 30 or 40 lambs in at a time and they'd roll in down the back on the rail and then the butcher would be cutting them up. One of the butchers would be cutting them up on the bandsaw, prepping them, like breaking them down, and then all the butchers would be in the front serving customers as well as prepping all the lamb. And the amount of people that used to stand back and just watch the production happening, you know, it was incredible. We, you know, as a butcher, you just do it. You don't think twice about it. But it's mesmerizing for some people, and they really appreciate the skill that goes into breaking down an animal. Like, not everybody can get a carcass of beef and, as you found out, and can just walk up and start breaking it down because it's a skill that nobody else has. I've even spoken to a nurse who said, I would much rather be operated on by a butcher because their hands aren't as shaky as what a doctor's are.
Oh, not the ones that drink a lot. Butchery, learning the art form of it, it's a quantity of experience as well as a quality of experience. When you cut meat for people on the spot, you don't know what you're about to do. Every situation is different and the performance requires you to improvise and get better. When you do it like that, I think it makes butchers better. I have, like, right now I've got a team of three butchers that are all new, that are doing really, really well, and they're very open to a learning attitude. And in the small time that they've been here, all three of them have improved a lot in their butchery capabilities to cut meat in a way that I'm trying to coach them to, which is ultimately I'm trying to give people the steps, but it's up to them to do the work. I can show them the steps that I use and I can show them the end result. Eventually, they're going to take those tools, they're going to apply it to their own body type and their own skill type, and they're going to do it their own way. But the result is going to be the same. It's about getting that high quality result and getting there. And there's cues, you know, there's cues that you can that you can follow in terms of practicing how to cut.
Yeah. And mate, with the dry aging, so you're dry aging the whole carcass. You're not just doing the rumps and the loins and the...
Doing both based on demand. So the idea is that you have a carcass, you let it hang a period of time, and then you can break it up and then hang it for longer in primals. But I do both, absolutely. And the more larger the piece of meat is that's being dry aged, the better the outcome is.
Yeah.
That's just my opinion, and I base my business on that opinion.
It's better financially too, because you're not losing as much in wastage. Your smaller pieces are gonna lose a lot more moisture and they're going to dry out a lot quicker than what a larger piece does anyway. I've seen butchers having four-quarters sitting in their dry aging room, and I'd go sort of, why are you doing that? Chuck is a casseroling steak, so it's not going to benefit that much from dry aging, except it might increase the flavour. You know, there's only so much you can do with blade. Blade's not a really good grilling steak, your blade steak, but yet again.
You know what, though? I would actually disagree with you, to be honest. And I think that is the general consensus, and I've heard that from a lot of people, and that's something that I hypothesized the opposite. I'm a big believer that dry aging maximizes the texture of any mussel, and it intensifies the flavor overall. Now, if the mussel's main texture concept is tenderness, so let's say an eye fillet, the dry aging will make it as tender as possible up until a point, right? It will influence its tenderness, and it will also influence its flavor. In saying that, with something like a braising piece of meat, if I ask you this, have you ever come across like a chuck that's no good? Like it's just floppy?
Yeah, an old cow.
Right. When you dry age stuff, you are moving it on the spectrum from worst possible outcome to best possible outcome, right? And I'm telling you, when you dry age even a chuck and you work with it, there is a flavor intensity. There is a different feeling in the meat when it's in its raw state. Then when you actually cook it, you're going to get the best possible result. Dry aging works by reducing the moisture content inside the mussel. Moisture is the enemy of flavor. Water content will hinder Maillard reaction, okay? And Maillard reaction is what gives you flavor. So in terms of cooking a piece of chuck that's been dry aged, because it has less water content, you are going to get a better crust on searing it. Some people don't sear it though, so let's just throw that out the window. Let's just say you're just going to boil a piece of chuck in water. I guarantee if you take a body that's been dry aged for 4 to 6 weeks, even 2 weeks, compared to a very, very fresh chuck, and you boil them in water, you're going to get a level of flavor intensity and a differentiation in the textures of all the small mussels that is very divisible in the dry aged product. And in the fresh product, it's just all going to be the same sloppy, tender mess of broken down. And that chuck isn't going to taste like much. And also, the other way of testing out this theory is mince it. If you mince it and you try the meat, you're going to find that immediately the flavor profile is far more pronounced. It has a much larger depth of flavor, and there is a much less amount of water that comes out of the meat. And that water that's in the meat is underhanging, in my opinion. I think that the number one reason why some meat is of a lower quality than other meat is the amount of time that it's hung. That's my opinion. And I think that that's before the breed, that's before the feed, that's before everything. It's underhanging.
Yeah, hanging does, mate, well, aging meat, obviously, yes, it does change the structure of the mussel. It makes it a lot more tender, gives it more flavour. Most butchers, I suppose, speaking for majority butchers, it's not financially viable for them to hang beef for that long, like for 3 or 4 weeks. 28 days is optimum, I think, for dry aged meat. That's when it reaches a peak. Yes, it will get a little bit better, but over time,
that's correct.
It takes more time. So the longer it's hanging, the more yield you're going to lose. But in most cases, butchers that are buying in fresh bodies of beef, you know, I used to hang them for about 7 days. I'd get them in on the week before I was going to use them. So in those days, meat was a lot cheaper. But at any price, it's still a big expense to have hanging there. And some guys can do it. Some butchers can hang it. They have got the facilities. I think these days, the reason why so many butchers are using more carton meat or getting in broken beef and lamb and pork is because they don't have the hanging facilities, they don't have the rail systems, they don't have much at all to work with. So they're in shopping centres or they're in a small shop that doesn't have those facilities.
That is 100% true. That is all that it breaks down to. And then the other way of looking at it is if you look at your cool room as cubic metres of space, right? One body of beef, which weighs 250 kilos, is the same amount of space as maybe 1,000 kilos of boxed meat, right? Because you could fit in the same amount of space and you can turn it over quicker. You can just sell steak to people because a lot of people just want to buy steak. They don't want to buy chuck. They don't want to buy blades, all these things. And that's what it comes down to. You know, and that's how I differentiate myself from other people. But you're absolutely right. It does come down to a financial thing because it's very hard to make money in the butchery industry. And butchers are working hard as it is. And you're already doing a 12 to 14 hour day, let alone a 12 to 14 hour day where you've got to break bodies all day.
In the area where you are, so the majority of your customers are walk-ins, obviously, from the area.
Yeah.
Where you are, it's such a multicultural area and like of inner Sydney. As I came down the street the other day, the amount of cafes and different types of restaurants that are there, what sort of an impact does that, have a great impact on your, I suppose, your, not so much your day trade, but your trade for the night? Do you find that that has an impact on that?
To be honest, Marrickville's a huge suburb and it's very eclectic. The old part of traditional Marrickville, which is the ethnic families, the older people, none of them shop with me. None of them are interested, right? There's still plenty of butcher shops where you can get a kilo of T-bones for 17 or 2 kilos for 16, right? There's ones like that on my street. People go to that butcher shop. There's lots of people that live in the surrounding inner western suburbs that come to our shop to get the meat. And there's heaps of people from all over Sydney that once shopped with me at my old shop or have heard about us through social media or through recommendations from their friends, and they'll travel to Marrickville to our shop, which I'm very proud of because it's extending our reach beyond just the local community. And the local community is very strong and it's very large, and I still get new people every day that have never heard of my shop before.
Yep.
And it's really hard because butcher shops, most of them have been around for 20 plus years, right? So you're bound to have people that have been there before. It's very rare that you get people show up to a new butcher shop. Like, what's a new butcher shop? I can't think of any, right? Most of them are well established.
Yeah.
You know, so, and I'm one of the newer ones. So I guess I look at it as a silver lining, which means that people have an opportunity to try. And they come into my shop and it's a very different format. Like, it's not like a behind the counter service. It's more of an open plan service. And you walk in and there's always people in there working and there's meat in front of you. And we put a lot of effort into the display of products that we make, the meat products and the non-meat products. And we try and really welcome everybody that comes in and give them individual attention.
Yeah.
It's very much like, I look at it like it's getting a haircut, right? If Doug comes in, Doug might need 10 minutes. The person behind Doug might have to wait a little bit. But as soon as Doug's done, I'm going to give this guy his full attention and the lady behind them their full attention. Some people are quick. Some people don't want the chit chat. Some people aren't interested, or some people really like it. But everybody gets an opportunity to get that high level of interaction with the butcher. And a lot of people come back for that, I think. And they also come back for the meat, obviously, and the products that we make. But it's that different format. Some people hate it. Some people do not like it at all, but there's more people that like it,
yep.
You know, which I'm very grateful for because I know that it's radical.
You mentioned about the non-meat products. So going on to all that great preserves and pickles that you've got there, Amina, your partner, like a lot like other wives and partners of butchers, that they play a big role in the business. So she looks after all that side of it. She does all the pickles and preserves and sauces.
All of that is her brainchild. So we buy in-season fruit and vegetables.
Mm-hmm.
And she makes an array of savory and sweet things. And we seal them in jars. And they're pickles, they're jams, they're relishes. We make refrigerated things, non-refrigerated things. A lot of cooked meals that are frozen, kids' meals that are frozen. You know, and they're starting to become a really popular part. The butcher shop industry, it's hard because your product is depleting. It's constantly going off. It's like having a flower shop, right? Everything's going off. It's got to go, right? But you can't give the impression to people that it's got to go because then it looks like it's bad quality, right? So you got to play it cool and you got to have some really nice different products that are going to complement the meat that you sell because you can't just sell people meat. I mean, it doesn't matter how much meat Doug eats. Doug can only buy so much meat, right? So I can only get so much of a sale out of one person. So we try and do artisan products that are made family style in small batches that really have a lot of flavor and they're made from scratch. Pretty much 95% of the products that we make are completely made from scratch. The only things that we sell that aren't are like the eggs and the milk. Everything else we make totally from raw vegetables. We make brines. We pickle things. We season things. We spice things. We do a lot of smoking. Try and make everything with original recipes. And a lot of it is all Amina's ideas. And she's in the shop all the time making the display look really, really enticing. And it's a big eye catcher. In fact, our display of jars and things, we put that in front of the meat. You know, that's where you can see through the window because that gets people excited. You know, we've got people that come to the shop every day that don't even buy meat. They just buy pickles, you know.
What's the most popular pickle that you sell?
Oh, probably the dill pickles and the bread and butter pickles. It's very popular. And all of our tomato sauces. Amina makes a passata, which is like in a big liter jar. And it's kind of a straightforward, intense, flavorful tomato passata. And then she uses that to make probably four or five different pasta sauces. Out of that one mother passata, and just stuff from our frozen section is going gangbusters at the moment, you know, which is great. You know, a lot of lasagnas, ragus, pulled porks, chicken nuggets that we make. We make garlic bread out of garlic that we smoke and that we emulsify and combine with butter and then put in bread rolls and freeze them and make it like a garlic bread that you cook in the oven that you can get from Woolies, and people love it. You know, we sell tons of them.
And with your sausages, quick question, do you use a premix or you make them from scratch?
No, I don't use any premixes and we don't use any preservatives. I'm a big believer in doing everything from scratch. I reckon everything is better from scratch. Anybody out there that's smoking a brisket at home in their home smoker and they want to buy a flavored rub from somewhere, if you put some effort in and you buy some high quality spices and you make something from scratch, it's better. The best example I can give you is salad dressing. There's no good salad dressing that comes pre-made, but if you make it yourself, you can make something amazing. It's all about high quality spices, high quality ingredients, and method. High quality meat obviously is important, right? But don't even worry about that. It's about method. It's about applying different methods to making your sausages. And you can achieve different textures, you can achieve different end products, different thicknesses, sizes, everything. Because it entices the customers, but it's also, they're good products to make. It's fun to make sausages.
Yeah, I remember the first time I made sausages, I moved from South Australia to Sydney. I was here for 2 days. I got a job at Forestville. First job was to make sausages. They said, okay, make them. I'd never made sausages because where I worked in Adelaide, we had a factory where they were all done. So, you know, we were in the central market area in Adelaide. So we were a very busy shop only for about 2 or 3 days of the week.
Yeah.
But there was so much manual work there, we didn't have that time. So I think it took me about 4 hours to do a batch of sausages. I remember the boss coming out saying, haven't you finished yet? God, sorry, mate. Never done this before, but I got better at it. But now it's, you know, it was a real labor-intensive sort of thing. These days we've got mixer mincers. There's a lot more automation involved in it. But I love making sausages now. I've got a little mincer here. I've got my little hand-cranked sausage filler.
Yeah.
And I make a Mexican sausage, a ring stinger. I love them.
Yeah.
Even in my butcher shop when I used to make them, you get a few customers come in on the Saturday afternoon or late Saturday morning. We shut at midday. And they'd be going, you got any ring stingers left? I say, sorry, I've run out. And they go, and I used to have a few left over every now and again, so I'd chuck them in the freezer.
Yeah.
So then they'd be rifling through the freezer looking for them, and they'd buy them frozen. And the best thing about that was the buggers used to get hotter when you froze them. I don't know why. But the flavor used to intensify, and mate, they were brilliant. But yeah, I still make them.
You know, it's funny you say that. I've been running my shop for 7 years. It wasn't until 2 years ago that I got a sausage filler. I was making it all hand cranked. You know, I had a vice to the table. Like in fact, up until a year and a half ago, I didn't have a bandsaw and I didn't have a vacuum sealer.
Wow.
I just did it all with a handsaw and with a meat cleaver, and I made sausages by hand. I didn't have a mixer mincer. I started with a number 27 Italian mincer. Used to clog up always. I used to hand mix sausages for 4 years. I was doing batches of up to 10 kilos hand mixing. You know, like you do it the hard way, you appreciate it. You know, it's like automated driving or something. If you can't do it the hard way, you're not going to appreciate it. And then one day when you're stuck, right, and the power goes out, you got to go out the back, you got to dust off that old hand crank filler, and you got to make it happen,
yep.
You know?
Yep, yep. Believe me, something always goes wrong in the butcher shop, as you'd well know.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I know.
All righty, mate. We're coming to the end of it now. So we're going to introduce a new segment now, and it's called the Final Fast Four Questions. So you ready?
Sure.
Okay. What's your go-to cut of meat and the best way you prepare it?
Rump steak or rump of any animal. How would I prepare it? Everything's got to be thick. And if it was cooked over charcoal or wood fire, that's how I would do it.
Beautiful.
With salt.
Yeah, that's all you need. Alrighty. What would you bring if you could take just one item to a deserted island?
What would I bring to a deserted island? I don't know. I would take something that had Spotify on it and music. I should say loved ones.
Yeah. Come on, man. If you could have dinner with any three people, dead or alive, who would it be and why?
I would have dinner with my... I would bring my sons to meet my dead grandfather and I would have dinner with him. Because he only ever met one of my sons, not the other two. And I would cook him lamb because he loved lamb.
Yeah.
And I would sit down with him again.
So, last one. What are you not very good at?
What am I not very good at? I'm not good at getting pork bones super clean. I'm not good at hitting the bone skin on pork bones. Because the bones that, like, the way I bone stuff, I really focus on the tip and scraping the bones and getting them clean. And I find that really hard to do with pork because the pork bones are always slightly more curved than beef and lamb. And the bone skin is a lot thinner. And the animal is way younger, realistically, in the lifespan. And it's harder to bone clean.
Mate, look, it's been an absolute pleasure to have you on board, mate. I really love your enthusiasm and your the way that you're running your business. It's I wish you all the very best for the future. And I'll have to come down there again one day and grab some of those pickles off you, mate, because I'm a big fan of them.
I appreciate it. Thank you for having me on. And I just want to say I feel like you're one of the original people that on some sort of media format in Australia that's promoting meat cutting and butchering. So like back from these MLA videos they used to do. So I appreciate them. And I know that a lot of people looked up to those videos and look up to you. So it's cool that you're doing this and you're bringing to light all these small businesses and butchers.
Thanks, mate. I've got a passion for this industry. I love butchery. I'd still jump on the tools tomorrow. I would have jumped on them the other day if I had time and given you a bit of a hand there, but...
We needed to bone brisket, so...
All right, mate. Well, thank you very much, and I'll look forward to catching up with you soon.
All right. Thanks, Doug.
Cheers, Marcus.
Bye-bye.